The work session on House Bill 2469. Representative Kotek.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Hope everyone had a good weekend. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44. And we are back today to discuss amendments for House Bill 2469. Many of you, well, all of you should have received the Dash 10s on Friday with some handwritten notes on them. What you have before you today are the Dash 12s. Which incorporate essentially the hand notes, some of the changes that we needed to make on the Dash 10s. What I thought we'd do is walk through the Dash 12s, and then I would like to make some comments about the Dash 2s and the Dash 11 amendments. And then I think the order will be then to have the department make some comments, and then there are a couple advocates who would like to make some comment on the amendments, you know, and have some questions answered. There'll probably be some final tweak shed on all of this, and I think we're scheduled for, hopefully, final work session on Friday. So for the Dash 12s, as we reported last time, these are the amendments, what we're calling the omnibus amendments. These are the agreements out of the work group. And I'm just going to highlight the key sections. On page one of the Dash 12s, line 7. This is starting with item 3 there, the department shall. These are some extra beefed up sentences around the assessment and what we're going to do in terms of when someone is trying to enter into the TANF program, the level of assessment that we are going to be providing for those individuals. Again, with the emphasis here being the better we assess at the front end, the more appropriate the different tracks of services an individual and their child will have access to. Maybe I'll just go through and then take questions. Moving down to line 13, this is the change to the area that talked about the types of activities that would be in the jobs program. They differ from the Dash 10s in that we added in a few items. For example, what I really like about this language is we're talking about suitable activities and with a goal of promoting family stability and financial independence. I think these are excellent values to have in statute. And then by suitable activities, we talk about job readiness activities or employment, vocational rehab or training, remedial secondary or post-secondary education, community service, or other activities that reduce or eliminate barriers to full participation in the program or to employment. We wanted to make sure that we had some sense of intent there, what we're talking about in our jobs program. So that those are the changes there. On page 2, I'll draw your attention to that, starting on page 2, line 5, where it starts, a needy caretaker. This is from line 5 down to line 20. This is the section with some revisions around new mothers. This clarifies at what point in time a new parent is required to participate in the jobs program, which is written out, Job Opportunity and Basic Skills Program. Specifically, we made some changes that we addressed earlier around teen parents. And I'm trying to find them. Line 18. Thank you. Yeah, what we're doing here is clarifying a couple things. The current program, after 3 months, a parent is required to participate in the jobs program. The language here would change that to 6 months after birth of child for required participation. It also clarifies what we're doing around teen parents. In line 18, it says, talking about younger parents having to participate 16 weeks after the birth of a child if they're under 20. And notice that we make a preference for educational activities in the jobs program there.
Okay. Representative, mm-hmm. I'm going to allow questions because
sure.
I have questions as we
go along.
So, okay, but this is to...
I know it's Monday morning.
Yes. Caretaker relative. I mean, I understand you're trying to get at a teenager who has a child,
mm-hmm.
and you're not wanting her to be required to go back to school or seek work until the baby is 16 weeks of age. Who would be the caretaker relative?
That is the parent, Madam Chair.
Why wouldn't you say parent?
Chair Tomei, Vic Todd, Administrator for the Self-Sufficiency Programs in DHS. That's a term that is used because it can be a non-needy caretaker relative, and so it's referred to as a caretaker, the adult.
You're not...
I'm sorry.
Carolyn Follow-up, yes. But... You're really talking about the parent of the baby. You're not talking about the sister or the mother of the girl who had the baby, right?
Chair Tremaine, that's correct. In most cases.
When would it not be the case?
If the mother did not have custody of the child, it could be actually the father that has custody. In which case, it's still the parent, but it's the caretaker relative.
Wouldn't it be clearer if you just said parent?
Conferring with the program manager who thinks that the term needy caretaker relative is probably the appropriate term to use there from a program standpoint.
Didn't we have passed a bill that said we've got to speak in plain language? It seems to me that if you're talking about a parent, the parent of the child that we're referring to, that it's better to say parent. I mean, this could be interpreted any number of ways.
Chair Tomei, upon further consultation, parent does sound like a good word.
Okay.
So just to clarify, so then it would be appropriate. We will discuss with the department where, throughout the amendments, it makes sense to say parent. The challenge is that the official term, because we do have a third of our caseload on which there are non-needy caretaker relatives, i.e., in general, non-parents.
So the
clarification. But in this case, we are talking about parents. The intent being, if you're a teen parent, after 4 months, you're back into some kind of engagement with a preference to education. Other parents have until 6 months to participate, with the idea that a little slightly longer time in that those first few months with the child are very beneficial in terms of outcomes. Other questions in that section? So we'll get back to that parent issue.
Okay, so now that we've stopped you, and we use the term up on line 5, a needy caretaker relative. So there you're not talking about the young parent, correct? You're talking about
Madam Chair, that
broader
is, we're talking about parent
class.
In general there. We don't really reference the teen parent until...
So would that be anyone other than the parent?
Parents. Could be mother or father or both.
But you're not talking about grandparents or aunts or uncles.
Madam Chair, no. Those would be what we call or what is called non-needy caretaker relatives.
So again, couldn't you use the word parent?
We could. I think what we'll try to do is go back through, confer with the department on this. If we can use parent where possible for clarification, and I think when we get to explain this on the floor, that would probably be helpful. For those reading this, mm-hmm. It is a challenging phrase.
Okay, so now I've stopped you.
No, that's
on
better.
That. So on the first page, line 8, mm-hmm. caretaker relative, again, are you talking about the parent of the child, or could it be a grandparent or an aunt or uncle?
That's just the initial assessment. That would be the parent or parents, yes.
So you will look at that one too, mm-hmm. right?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
In line 11, since it has to do with medical complications due to the pregnancy, wouldn't that specifically be the mother?
Line 11 on the first
line
page?
Line 11 on page 2. Yes, that particular exemption would apply to the mother, I would assume.
On page 2, line 11?
Sorry.
So we're talking there about the mother?
That's true. Madam Chair, clarification, and Representative Gelser, it could also apply to the father, because if the mother is having complications, the father might not be able to participate. Though the father's not having the complications, if there are complications for the two-parent family, the father might not be able to participate in the program while he's taking care of mm-hmm. the mother.
So would that be... Would we want to insert parent there, perhaps?
Chair Tomei, what we'll do is go through this bill entirely and look for where that may be a more appropriate term to use and try to sort all through this for
that. Okay, we won't belabor that then. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will strive for readabilities and common sense here, so thank you. It's funny when you get so used to using these terms, you're like, well, of course that means this. It's like, well, that's not that obvious. Thank you for pointing that out. Other questions on page 1 or page 2 before I move on?
Okay.
So starting on page, or we're still on page 2.
Yes,
ma'am. Yes, thank you. On page 2, we're not quite finished there. On line 23, this is... This gets to a certain portion of the child support pass-through, which we're talking about passing a certain level of the child support through back through to the parent. I would note that on line 26, when we spoke the other day when we heard for testimony, we made a change, but this is actually what it should read. I don't know if you remember that previous document. We changed it from 100 or 200 to 100. It should be $200. We clarified with the Child Support Division and the fiscal that they've given us. So the disregard would be no less than $50 of the amount of child support received for each child, up to $200, or the maximum established by federal law. So I just want to, this is correct now. Moving on to page 3. Starting on line 4, which is begins with 5A, this is the critical section that talks about what will happen before the department is allowed to proceed with a sanction on the family for lack of participation. And like I mentioned the other day, this is probably the one part that I still have some concerns about, because a full family sanction is a very... serious action to take on a family. So what we've inserted here is some very clear language about at what point the department would be able to do the sanction. And I think what's really critical here is the way we talk about barriers. In fact, let me just read through this, because I think it's really critical. Department may not reduce the family's aid payment as a method of encouraging full engagement in the jobs program pursuant to Section 4 until the department determines that the non-compliant caretaker relative, here we're talking about the parent, that they have no barriers, that they have the ability to be fully engaged in the program. Unfortunately, we've had instances where, although a family would like to be engaged, there are issues that they're facing that have not been assessed or identified, and makes it challenging for them to participate. Sanction would not be implied. Actually, Joel, do you want to walk us through this, since you worked with this closely, if you don't mind?
Yeah, sure.
That might be quicker than me doing it.
So the department may not reduce aid. So for the record, Chair Tomei, my name is Joel Fisher, Legislative Assistant to Representative Kotek. What we set up is a language saying, kind of getting specifically at who can be sanctioned so that people aren't being, we're not terminating aid to families that really should not have their aid terminated. So it's important that, let's see, line 8 starts, this person has no barriers or refuses to appropriate, to take appropriate steps to address identified barriers to participation in the program. They have to have the ability to be engaged in the program but are willfully non-compliant with the requirements of their individualized case plan. And that's kind of really getting at the crux of saying, you know, people who don't have any barriers, who can be participating, but simply just are not participating, you come to a point where you have found an individual who should not be receiving aid any longer on the program because they're not participating and don't have any barriers or are not addressing them.
Thank you, Joel.
Thank you, Joel. So again, I think the key here is participation review, making sure that there are no reasons that this family cannot be participating fully. Before we then move into what is essentially the full family sanction policy starting on line 26, which is a gradual sanctioning in that once that a family is determined to meet, has not met any of the other criteria that we just talked about, then the sanction would be applied. And once the family started engaging again, then the grant would come back, and it goes into the details there.
If I could add one thing, Chair Tomei, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher. One of the other things, I should say that full family sanctions was probably the most difficult thing for the work group to come to consensus around, and you could probably say we actually don't have much of a consensus, but this is something that we feel is probably just I had the right thing to do. Representative Kotek still feels very strongly that we should not have full family sanctions. But for all intents and purposes, I think that we've written the best full family sanction out of all of the various different TANF programs across the country. One of the things that we don't mention here in statute, but I think we should talk about to get on the record, is that in this participation review, and revolving the community in reviewing somebody's participation in the program, it's important that a child welfare worker is involved in the process to so that the department can assess the harm that will happen to the child if they are no longer receiving aid. However, involving the child welfare workers has sometimes meant that people will just go ahead and instead of conducting the participation review for fear of having children removed from the home or whatever, they will just completely opt out of the program and not show up. So it's important that the department is also taking a look at how they involve the child welfare worker. Are they at this participation review meeting, or are they looking at the case and the participant separately, so that the participant is not in fear that their children are going to be taken away from them, which results in them just leaving the program, where we are not then engaging these people and we've probably done more harm to the children.
Okay. Thank you, Joel.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I have a question to the department about your ability to manage this piece of the bill. Does it seem, because I know there's not consensus, and it's a lot easier to just say, close the door and say you don't comply, therefore you're out. But this requires some management of that case, and I just want to hear your thoughts about that piece of it. Is it manageable for the department?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, we believe it is manageable, and we do believe it's the best approach. In that what we have said all along in redesigning this program is the need for stronger assessment evaluation across the board. And so that's really the intent in terms of where we're going with this program. So I believe it is manageable.
Thank you.
So then starting on line 26 on page 3, it moves into the details of how the sanction policy would be applied, which takes us into the middle of page 4. So starting on line 16, we get into the area of time limits and how we apply them. As you recall, the federal government has set a 60-month time limit for use of federal funds, but they also provide a level of hardship exemptions up to 20% of the caseload. And has that funding document been distributed? Did you get the table? Yes, that one. One of the things that you mentioned briefly last time was clarifying how 2469 will be funded in the different ways. And this is, the table is an attempt to give you a sense of the different types of funding sources for the different components of this redesign. And you'll notice on there that it talks about time limits and hardships. So up to 20% of the caseload, we can continue to use federal TANF dollars. The way 2469 has been written is to bank months of hardship that then we can extend past the 60-month time limit. And I just want to check over my notes here to make sure I'm getting this right. So we have the 60-month time limit for TANF adults. And that sends a message that TANF is a temporary program. However, it also addresses an important policy question of what happens to families who are unable to get off at 60 months. And we are taking advantage of the flexibility under TANF law. We have a time limit policy that will provide sufficient protection for the families and their kids. We're also establishing exemptions. So you have the limit, but an exemption in terms of the types of hardships. Our policy will stop the clock if there are hardships. And we're allowing for, if we have additional families above the 20% caseload exemption, that they could continue to stay on the program. And I think I mentioned last time that in the course of the 60 months, if there are hardships that have impeded a family's progress towards self-sufficiency, that those months of hardship can be banked, and that could be the extension as well. So we're trying to cover all the bases, that we're not basically saying at 6 months you're out the door when there are obviously issues going on for a particular family. There were some families who will never reach the 60-month time limit, and then there are others that will have hardships that will need to be addressed.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Kotek. I'm sorry I didn't get this question to you ahead of time, but in reading through the hardships on line 27,
page 4, line 27,
has a certified learning disability. And in the section after that, it talks about, it puts the condition, has a mental health condition or alcohol or drug abuse problem that prevents the individual from obtaining or maintaining employment. I'm wondering if it might be helpful to have that kind of a connector to the certified learning disability, because it seems that a person with a certified learning disability would have that certified learning disability perpetually, so that in any month that that person was receiving aid, they would by nature of that disability continue to have that disability.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser. So let me just make sure I'm understanding.
Okay.
Yes, clearly the certified learning disability is not something that ends at the 60 months. And so you're saying that, I'm trying to figure out if that's part of.
Sure. Maybe I could ask the question more clearly. So if I'm reading this correctly, it doesn't count towards the 60-month limit on receipt of aid if you meet any of these qualifications during one of those months. So one of those months is listed as has a certified learning disability. If I have a certified learning disability, I'm going to have that certified learning disability in February, March, April, May. I'm always going to have that certified learning disability. So would it make sense to add language that connects it to that learning disability is preventing that individual from obtaining work, rather than there would be no time limits ever for people with learning disabilities?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, the time limits that are being established through this legislation, actually, the federal time limits continue. And what this does really is establish additional exemptions from that. And so the intent here is to ensure that if a client gets to 60 months, that with this methodology, that there have been created what people refer to as banked months that would still enable them to continue on. So during that 5 years where they had the learning disability, they would have banked months, if you will. And so, in essence, they will have another five years of eligibility with that before you would get to a consideration that that may not be, an exemption. And so I think that it essentially it builds in the continuation of that, of recognition of that disability.
Representative Kelsey, is what you're getting at a permanent exemption?
Right. I think what I'm getting at is when you have a certified learning disability, it's not going to go away, regardless of the types of services that you have. So as written, it seems like this would mean that any person with a learning disability would be perpetually eligible for aid. And I'm just wondering, a learning disability, is that dyslexia or is that autism?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, thank you for that point. My assumption is if the program is functioning the way we are hoping it will be functioning, there'll be proper assessment and services and supports that will allow the person, even with a certified learning disability, to move along the path of self-sufficiency. Now, what I think this recognizes is that there might be challenges to imposing a time limit on an individual like that if, depending on resources, depending on the type of services they need, that we want to make sure that that is flagged in a sense that when we get, they are included. As you notice, this is an OR list, so it's one or more of these things. The goal being to help that individual get off assistance, which I think most people want to do, but with the understanding that at 60 months that might not be very realistic. They, more likely end up in that 20% exemption grouping, or some banked months, continue as long as necessary. But again, the goal I think is that this is a temporary program, and I would hope that this, the goal is to have the program function in a way that even with someone with a certified learning disability is finding their way and having the support they need. Does that help? I don't know if that. It's not a guaranteed no time limit. I don't read it that way, but it's definitely a flag to the department that if someone has a certified learning disability, hello, we need to be paying attention. They might need some supports. We can't exactly kick them off the program in 60 months.
So one more follow-up.
So
there's not an intentional difference between just having a certified learning disability and the next clause that links alcohol or drug abuse or a mental health condition with the inability to obtain or maintain employment because of that. So in the next one, it's got a barrier, and the barrier is hooked to that barrier causes an inability. And with the certified learning disability, it's just having one, the way that it's written. So it's not intended. Your intention isn't that a person with a learning disability would always be on TANF.
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, no.
Okay.
Though this is really, in some ways, a laundry list of things that the department should be paying attention to with respect to the time limit. So there's a variety of issues, variety of barriers. Some of them could stay with a person for their lifetime, but doesn't mean that they can't move along. And then others, after some treatment or other services, might be diminished. So, yeah, it's a diverse list of things.
Okay. Representative Gilliam has a question.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all for being here. I purposely did not submit a series of trick questions that I have here. I actually just want a real quick definition of maintenance of effort dollars for those of us who are behind the times.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam. Maintenance of effort dollars are actually the term refers to in for the temporary assistance in new families programs funds that the state spent on assistance in 1994, and the state is required to spend a percentage of that, and the base level is 80%. In order to draw down the federal TANF grant. Is that?
Okay, so thank you.
I'd be happy to talk with you separately and give you more information.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Maurer.
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. And so this is, for me now, a clarification of what Representative Gelser was saying. In lines 28 and 29, the statement is mental health condition, alcohol, drug abuse, that prevents the individual from obtaining or maintaining employment. So in line 26, it could be worded the same way. Is a victim of domestic violence, et cetera, that prevents the individual from obtaining or maintaining. I mean, each one of those is about prevents the individual from obtaining or maintaining employment. That's what we're talking about in this laundry list of exceptions or extension. Is that?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, that is correct. In fact, in some ways, we might be confusing things by tagging that on line F, because it really is. If you're in,
yes, I agree.
Mm-hmm. And if you think that would be clearer, we could move that out so it just says, you know, victim of domestic violence, certified learning disability, mental health condition, you know, take out that extra prevents the individual from obtaining or maintaining employment, or we can move it to some other.
But I think it might be clearer just to take it out.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Maurer. Okay, I'm just going to stop this for a minute. We are not going to be able to get to House Bills 2734 or 2189 today, so if anybody is waiting to hear those, we will be hearing those at a later date. So nobody looks like they're getting up to leave. So
I do.
Everyone is riveted to Tana.
Okay.
So thank you for those comments. We'll clarify that again for readability. Page five, we get into the details around one moment, please. I just wanted to clarify on line 15 there, where we talk about the 60-month limitation. That's the language to clarify the idea of exemption in the banking, being able to bank hours. So it might not be clear from that, but that's what that's for in lines 15 through 18. Moving along, line 22. Sorry, it is Monday morning here. Hold on one second. On line 22, sorry for the delay there, this is the section that gets into participation in the post-TANF program. The work group decided that we needed some clarification around what happens if a caretaker relative, i.e. the parent, who is in the post-TANF program, what the participation requirements are if the engagement isn't going the way it should. This clarifies for the department what they need to do to verify that participation, because we were going to be needing that engagement in the post-TANF program for our work participation rate calculation. So that's what that language is, starting from 22 line through line 30. Moving on to page 6.
I'm going to stop you there for a second, Representative Kotek. Mm-hmm. So I'm of course, I flagged caretaker relative, but it seemed to me at first when we were talking about someone, a young woman, for instance, just having a baby and not being able to go back to school for several months, et cetera. But in further through this, are we talking about perhaps a grandparent or an aunt or uncle who might be taking care of, like in line 22, where it says caretaker relative? Are you specifically referring to the biological parents of the child, or could this be extended to other family members?
Chair Tomei, if the individual was included in the grant, they would be considered a needy caretaker relative. If it's a relative who's not included in the grant, then it becomes a non-needy caretaker relative. So you can have a non-parent in the grant if that child is part of the grant with their child.
Madam Chair, the challenge with the TANF program is, as I've mentioned, there's about a third of the caseload is really a child-only case, meaning there's no parent involved in the case, essentially. The child is receiving a grant, and there is a non-needy caretaker relative involved. So I think for simplification purposes, let us assume that, in general, this is applying to two-thirds of the caseload where there's a parent involved. Because the parent, there's an adult portion of the grant and a child portion of the grant. And when we talk about the caretaker relatives, we're referring to the adults who are participating in the grant along with their child.
Okay, just for further clarification for me. So if the parents of this child are out of the picture, it might be the grandparent caring for the child. Would that be covered in this section?
Perhaps the department could just briefly mention the expectations on the on those type of cases, because my understanding is we're really not talking about those cases.
Okay.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Leiter with Department of Human Services. The adults on the cases, really there's kind of three groups. There would be the parents, and then there would be someone being a caretaker relative. And caretaker relative would be the broadest definition. Then you'd have needy caretaker relatives, so that means that they're receiving aid from the department.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got just the parent on the grant as well. And the way that we had intended this program to work is that it would be needy caretaker relatives and parents if the parent was on the grant before. And so I think in some instances you may have some other relatives other than the parent if that relative was needy. So they're receiving aid, would be eligible for this, but it would not include people that were not actually needy to receive this aid. So I think some, depending on their status as far as on the grant or not on the grant, some non-parents would qualify.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. So on page 6 at the top, this is where we get into some of the language around the state SSI/SSDI family program. And we, in the course of the work group, it became clear we should add in SSDI, which is Social Security disability benefits as well as supplemental security income into this package. Not every person would be eligible for both, but there's enough overlap that we wanted to put that in there. The key part of the amendments on this is starting on line 7, going through line 18. This was in response to Representative Gelser's, I think, very helpful comments about, you know, the idea was not just to send somebody down a track and not have any options in terms of other employment opportunities or other resources. So this talks about providing information around opportunities for employment while receiving SSI, about employment resources available to SSI, SSDI participants. In line 16, it talks about offering participants the opportunity to participate in any suitable activity in the jobs program. In other words, there's a full range of services that comes along with this track, and we wanted to clarify that. I don't know if Representative Gelser had any comments. We've been working with folks on this, so... this is a really good addition, I think. It's really, this is the intent.
Thank you.
Starting on line 20, we get into some technical language about the child support pass-through, and that goes all the way through to page, you'll notice on page 7 it clarifies the $50 per child up to $200 per family, but then it keeps going and going and going through to all the way to line page 12. So that is language that relates to child support that apparently that used to be in the TANF statutes when we used to have the child support. So we're just putting it back in on the pass-through. All right. On page 12, line 25, you see some interesting and not terribly transparent language. This is getting to the point. This is about transitional medical assistance, making sure that if someone came into the program and they were assessed but immediately went into the post-TANF program, we wanted to make sure that the number of months needed to calculate for being eligible for transitional medical assistance wouldn't be somehow negatively affected. So this just clarifies that if you're coming into the program and somehow you move to post-TANF, you would still meet the eligibility requirements for transitional medical assistance, which is an important component for stability and success for the families to have that medical care. So that's what we're doing in lines 25, 26, and 27. Section 21 is the implementation of the child support pass-through, October 1 of 2008. That coincides with the federal fiscal year when the new rules in terms of allowing how the federal government will participate with the states around child support pass-through, that starts October 1 of 08. And then Section 22 is an emergency clause that we needed to add because the new regulations are out. We need to implement this as soon as we can. So that's what that is about. Any questions on the Dash 12?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I appreciate all the work on this, and I'm sitting here thinking a lot of this is triggered by your own description here, by the DRA, Deficit Reduction Act. So my question is, do you have any anticipation of resistance or cooperation from the federal government on this?
Chair Tomei, representing Gilliam, we're not anticipating any federal resistance to this. I think this is a pretty strong program, and I think it demonstrates what Oregon would be doing in a positive way to work with these families.
Can you follow?
Would
you have involved them, or would it be appropriate to involve them in your work group? Is there a particular reason why you would or wouldn't?
The Chair Tomei, Representative Gillen. They have not been involved in the, for example, the TANF Oversight Committee. We have had conversations with them about various issues. One of the issues that we are trying to, strengthen is honestly around the family, state family SSI program in terms of getting that component around employment in place, and that's we've had discussions with various federal people around that issue to try to make that a more attractive option.
Good. Thank you.
One last comment on the assessment piece, and I keep harping back to the assessment piece. On the Dash 12, on page 1, lines 7 through 12, which is really the assessment paragraph, I need to ask you your opinion whether or not you feel that language is strong enough regarding my desire to see that a medical assessment is included, because I know we can't require that. We can't force them to go. But is that strong enough is the intent heard that this is a critical piece for people that may not recognize that they have an issue, whether it's medical or not, and that I do not expect that these caseworkers are going to have the expertise necessarily to pick up on some of these things that are subtle. So in your opinion, is the language strong enough, or is the intent there that is at least my intent?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, thank you for that question. I do think this is stronger than the original draft, mm-hmm. Especially in the original draft, we just spoke vaguely around adopting appropriate screening and assessment procedures. I like the idea of a basic assessment tool. I think that kind of says we're going to have some consistency, we're going to have a tool. I like the idea of mentioning that referring a person to someone with relevant experience or specialized training, which I think is critical, which gets to some degree at the medical angle, that if there is some assessment that there is a medical issue, that's where the person is referred. I would not be opposed to adding even more language here. Maybe we can describe the assessment tool a little bit. That might beef that up even more, but it's definitely, I think, stronger than the first draft. I don't know if... And in terms of the medical, maybe the department wants to comment on what they're perceiving as basic assessment tool. That might be helpful.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, I think that we understand the intent and that we think it is probably strong enough, but I think I'm going to let Dave speak to that a little bit in terms of what we intend around that, and then we can look at, you know, if we need to add additional language.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, we are in the process of adopting a uniform kind of a self-assessment tool right now for all the recipients applying for TANF. And in there are a number of questions where the client can self-disclose issues around medical issues or medical issues, prospective medical issues of the family. If those issues come forward, we can refer the client to get appropriate documentation around those medical issues that would stop them from being able to participate or move forward in the program for that higher level of assessment. We have specific forms that we have them have the medical providers fill out that provides that information.
One follow-up.
Follow-up?
Yeah. And so it's clear that your intent is there, so I'm not asking for language changes. This tool is by rulemaking process, or is that just by policy? And so that you're consistent across the state so that everybody's using at least the same assessment tool.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, it would be in policy.
Okay. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that you don't have in front of you what I'm about to refer to, so let me apologize for that. But I shared with the committee today a letter that I had received from an attorney in Florence, Ronald Gerber, that was more general than this specific piece of legislation, but it speaks to the challenges of people getting the medical examinations necessary to qualify for Social Security disability or SSI. And my intention is that it just be considered in the course of our discussions of some of the other legislation around the bridge program that we're not going to get into today. But specifically, he does talk about how it's a little bit less cumbersome, perhaps, or less difficult for individuals who do qualify for TANF. And on page 2 of his letter, it says TANF pays for some evaluations, AMS evaluations, whatever that, acceptable medical source. I'm sorry, couldn't find the reference there. Fortunately, TANF pays for much of this if there are dependent children. There is a separate program that pays these expenses. So I'm sort of in a combination of follow-up to Representative Maurer's question, and then I was moving over into the SSI discussion. I don't believe that there's been any amendments, although I'm having trouble tracking all of them, to the what would be on page 8 of the original bill, line 6. The department shall assist families receiving aid under this section in qualifying for federal supplemental security income, including obtaining necessary medical records and evaluations. So specifically at this point, my reason to reference his concerns is just to sort of reassure myself and get on the record that the intent of the updates to the TANF program is to also provide the medical evaluations that people might need in order to qualify for SSI. Is that correct?
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, thank you for bringing that up, and thank you for the letter. I think, especially with the testimony from the Bridge Program bill, you know, the challenge we put people in when we don't provide access to the medical expertise they need to actually prove that they have an issue. It's this, you know, chicken or the egg discussion, and what we're providing in this program is a track with the necessary resources to make that evaluation, which is for, obviously, families with children.
Thank
we're
you.
Leaving out the childless adults here.
Follow-up? Just very quickly, that was the reason that I didn't reference a specific piece of legislation when I shared this letter, but since it kind of covered both areas, I wanted to mention it. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could just make a comment about the assessment tool and then move on to a couple other amendments. But in listening to this, I'm hoping that the department in developing this tool, and obviously advocates will work with the department hopefully on this, is there's that balance between having people self-identify but creating questions that will encourage the worker to tease out additional information to help people figure out if they might have some issues. I think back to the comments from the worker who testified when we had one of our initial hearings about, I realized that this woman was having trouble seeing. She wasn't going to put that down, but, you know, trying to figure out how to encourage that kind of engagement between the worker and the individual applying beyond the self-screening tool to get at some of that. So I think it's how that tool gets drafted with the idea of, you know, trying to tease out the types of challenges someone might be having, and A, might not realize it, or B, not might be willing to disclose right away, but with some encouragement might be able to get the resources they need.
I think I share some of Representative Maurer's discomfort in not having this in statute, and I'm not sure how that could happen. I mean, it sounds like we're depending on the department to come up with their assessment tool, which may not be uniform throughout the state.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not uncomfortable with that language. I just want to ensure that because this is an area, it's, you know, we're expanding a new frontier in assessment, and as long as I'm comfortable with an expressed intent stated as opposed to in language. I don't want to tie their hands, and knowing that we can't require people to get a physical examination, knowing we can't require someone to do a lot of this stuff, to me, you know, we need to highly encourage it. We need to try to find out. So it's not that I'm uncomfortable with the language. I just want the express intent statement.
Chair Tomei, and members of the committee, the department in Children, Adults, and Families is already engaged in, you know, additional training, and I've mentioned that before, around the client engagement, you know, training for staff and for, you know, both the line staff who are carrying cases as well as, you know, support staff and managers in terms of how to manage staff to that. And that's the intent there is to have that as an ongoing process. And the intent is to have a uniform methodology around doing assessment statewide. There will be variability in that because of the nature of different locations across the state. But the overall intent will be the same. So that is where we're committed to move. And I think Representative Maurer's comments are helpful in from the standpoint that we are moving to a new approach, and it is new territory. And so there is going to be learning going on. And so we have established at this point 7 different work groups within the self-sufficiency area that are looking at each of these areas in terms of how do we approach this statewide. And as that moves along, our intent is to bring in you know, advocates and other interested people to look at that in terms of what our intent is, so that we are moving on the same path.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, so that concludes the Dash 12 amendment. So what we'll do prior to Friday is whatever Dash version this is note on that final version of the omnibus amendments what small changes we've made to the Dash 12s. We'll just make some notes so you get those, so you have a sense of, because it sounds like we'll add a few, the parent caretaker relative issue and some other things. So the changes to the Dash 12s for the final group amendment should be relatively small. There are 2 other amendments that I just wanted to make note of, and then maybe give the floor over to the department and a couple advocates to make some comments. But the Dash 11s, which you also received on Friday, one of the things that came to our attention, and the reason it's not in the omnibus is, honestly, didn't have a chance to go back and talk to the entire work group about this. One of the intents, when we talk about moving a family into greater economic stability and long-term self-sufficiency, is the need to access post-secondary education. In 2003, legislation was passed to allow the department to allow a certain portion of the caseload to participate in post-secondary education as an allowable work activity. I believe it was 1% of the caseload. We fondly termed that the Parents of Scholars program that was modeled after the very successful program in Maine that would allow folks going on for higher ed as a way of greater self-sufficiency. The department currently has something called the Degree Completion Initiative. It's not as expansive as what we had originally envisioned with Parents of Scholars in terms of its restriction on the number of years. So we've proposed the Dash 11 amendments to do one simple thing. In the 2003 legislation, there was a caveat on there that program would be, or that option within the TANF program would be implemented if reauthorization happened at the federal level and allowed to use federal money for providing post-secondary education. Well, that didn't happen. If it told you anything, that was 2003. We thought reauthorization was happening the next year. It took almost, 2006. So what the Dash 11s do, and I think we passed around a copy of the original statute for you on Friday, is this would delete that particular language that ties it back to the federal dollars. So it would allow the department to do the 1% of the caseload with post-secondary education without having to use federal dollars. So that's what the Dash 11 is. And then the Dash 2 amendments that I believe you've all seen as well, this is an attempt to get at the very real problem that we have not increased our income, our eligibility levels and our grant levels since 1991 for our TANF program. And actually, Joel, do you mind describing these? Thank you.
So as Representative Kotick mentioned, we haven't raised the grant levels and the countable income levels in quite some time. So this the Dash 2 would do both. Currently, depending on the number of the size of the family, I think some of you have a chart that I had passed out on Friday, which the chart shows what your grant, the grant that you receive, and what it is as a percentage of federal poverty level. So right now it's anywhere between, 32 and 33 and 34, 35% of federal poverty level. So what we would do is kind of pin it right at 33% and say that the grant that that people will be receiving on the program will be at 33% of federal poverty level. That's actually bullet point E on the Dash 2s. Then we tie countable income to the grant level and saying that countable income will be twice what the grant level is. Currently, countable income as a percentage of federal poverty level is around 43 or 44%, depending on your family size. So to be eligible for TANF, you need to be making 43% of what federal poverty is. So we're talking about really not very much money at all. So we'd be raising that to 66%, which would allow people, it would allow for more people to be eligible for the program, and it would also allow people to work more hours before they made too much money and then became ineligible for the program.
Thank you, Joel. And Madam Chair, this would also help for our work participation rates. As Joel was mentioning, if we increase the eligibility limit somewhat, a family could work more, because right now if you work more than full-time at minimum wage or more than part-time at minimum wage, you make too much money to be on the program, and that would put you automatically into the new post-TANF program. If we increase the eligibility levels, people would stay on the formal program a little longer, and that would also count towards our work participation rates, which is ultimately one of the goals of doing this redesign. Well, we have to. The federal government's going to penalize us if we don't increase our work participation rate. Any questions on the Dash 11 or Dash 2s? I want to thank the committee. I mean, what we're trying to do here is put the best policy framework forward for redesigning TANF, a program that hasn't been looked at in more than a decade. And you're going to hear from the department that there are some challenges because right now the fiscal might be beyond what has already been earmarked in the governor's budget and the co-chair's budget. However, what I would hope the committee sees fit to do is to move on the best policy package that we can and allow us to have that discussion in the Ways and Means Committee. As I sit on the Human Services Subcommittee, I'm looking forward to having this bill come forward with what looks like the best policy. And then as I've spoken with Legislative Fiscal Office, it does happen, bills come forward that aren't necessarily accounted for in the proposed budgets, but maybe we find more money or we take things out if we don't have the money. But ultimately, that's a budgetary issue. Our job is, as I see it, to send forth the best policy. And that's what we've tried to do in 2469 and honestly with the Dash 11s and the Dash 2s. So you have some time to think those over. But with that, I think I'll wrap up and come back up on the dais. Any questions
of Representative Kotek? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
So the department is going to stay here and talk to us some more. Great.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I too would like to thank the committee as well as all of the participants in the work group. It was a very productive process, and I think we really have come forward with a lot of good policy discussion and choices. So with that, what I've provided to you is some testimony, which I will not go through every page of it, but wanted to, because we have talked about a lot of what's in there already, but did want to point out some issues, technical changes that we think would be helpful to this, as well as speak to some of the fiscal impacts that are not included in the governor's budget so that you're aware of the estimates around those. And I'm just going to go through this fairly quickly, and of course we'll take questions as you have them. On page one really speaks to a lot of the issues that we have discussed already around the family SSI program and the TANF time limit and sanction policies. Beginning of the second page speaks to the exemptions for newborns. We've talked about that. House Bill 2469 included a proposal to eliminate deprivation, so that really isn't a new issue in terms of adding it to the bill. As I mentioned, that is not a policy change that was included in the governor's budget. And while the work group did have an agreement that from a policy standpoint, this is a policy that really stemmed from the former Aid Families with Dependent Children, it is a policy that is continued, and it would make sense to change that policy. However, it does have a fairly significant fiscal impact if that policy choice were made. And at this point, the estimate, as it's currently removing this policy, would be about $29 million general fund.
Madam Chair,
could you just give us that amount? Is that in here?
Very yes, long. It is. It's next to the bottom.
Got it. I see. Thank you. Yes, Representative Maurer.
I understand the $29 million, but why is the roll up more than double?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, the roll up there is because there's the program would load over time, and so if we began in October 1, it would take a while for the caseloads to increase.
Okay, I understand.
Follow up.
So in the fifth year, in the 12, it would go up even more. But then it would level off. Is that?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer. Yes, eventually it would level off. This analysis was based on looking at codes that we currently have around reason for denial. And so from that standpoint, it may be a fairly conservative estimate in terms of its roll-up or loading schedule, if you will.
Madam Chair, but you say conservative high, conservative low.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, what we did not attempt to do was to determine if there were additional families who were aware of the existing policy and were not applying. So that element of it is not factored into the.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And likewise, did we factor into the families who, once being denied, unfortunately would do things that would not be helpful and change their situation in such a way that would then make them eligible. We don't have any sense of that and how that would. So they could be on the program now. We just don't know it.
Chair Tomei, represent COTEC. No, we did not try to factor that piece in as well. That we, and from an eligibility standpoint, the staff attempt to determine that, but there is, you know, a certain extent that they can go to in terms of, you know, determining what you're speaking to.
Thank you.
On page three, speaks to some adjustments that we would like to see to some of the different work group compromise agreements. In that, on the first or the second paragraph there, where it speaks to the emergency clause, we would like to see that move to October 1, 2007, as that is what the governor's budget was premised on in terms of implementation. In the next paragraph, we speak to the parents of newborns. What we would like to add is some language that would enable us to require these new parents to participate in family stability activities as appropriate, so that they are not precluded from participating in some activities that may be parenting or other types of activities. The fourth paragraph speaks to the child support increase, and again, this is a fiscal impact that is not incorporated into the governor's budget of about $900,000 for the 07-09 biennium. The next paragraph speaks to the change in the sanction policy, which we talked about quite a bit. The modification results in a change in the amount of savings that we had originally projected in the governor's budget, and that reduces that to about $100,000 general fund. On page four, we speak to some additional technical changes in the first three paragraphs. First paragraph is just adding some language, again, that gives us some ability to define the term fully engaged would mean in role. The second paragraph speaks to the revision in the proposal would say until the department has screened for and so on. We would like that to read that we have provided the opportunity to be screened for. The next paragraph speaks to the when a client can ask for a hearing, and we would like to put a time frame around that so that we limit the ability to come back a year later and ask for a hearing. Next paragraph is speaking to the time limits change, which we have spoken about. The last two paragraphs are talking about the post-TANF program and the expansion of the transitional medical program. This expansion also is not in the governor's budget, and we're estimating that it would have a general fund cost of $5.4 million general fund. On page five, we would like to make a further adjustment to the title of the Family SSDI program to make it clear that it is a state program and just refer to it as the pre-SSI SSDI program. Small item. The next paragraph speaks to adding language within the SSI-SSDI program, language, again, around being able to require family stability activities within that program. And then some language around ensuring that we're able to recover attorney costs. Amendments The House Bill 2469-2 amendments would change the income and the eligibility and payment standard. Also is not in the governor's budget. And we wanted to be sure that we had spoken to that in terms of the potential fiscal impact. What we expect to see is an increased number of cases, would need additional job support service dollars, and would also see an expected increase in the medical caseload. The projection that this would cause an additional need for a little over $46 million general fund in the 07-09 biennium. In the House Bill 2469-11 amendments, the issue related to the parents as scholars piece, we would like to, if that amendment is approved, have that modified so that we would implement that beginning with the second year of the biennium, October of 08, so that we are the intent there is, while we agree with this as a policy shift, we're also concerned in the first year with respect to achieving the participation requirements. And so this is a policy shift that we would be more comfortable with as we are achieving those participation requirements. So with that, I'll thank you and take any questions.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to thank the department for all the hard work you've put in on the work group. And this is my first look at this, but I think there's a lot of this we can combine into what is currently the Dash 12s. I thank you also for the detail that you've put into the fiscals. I don't want to get into a large debate about them. I look forward to the conversation and then the Ways and Means Subcommittee about some of the assumptions around those fiscals. But there are resource issues to providing the best possible program. And again, I'm hoping that we can have that discussion in Ways and Means, at what level we're able to purchase a program that will have the best outcomes. And I think I'll leave it at that for now.
Thank you, Representative.
Yes, Madam Chair, this is not pertaining to your testimony, but is actually back to the letter that Representative Cowan provided. And it's on the very last page of that letter, and this is a technical issue. Maybe not quite a third of the way from the top, where it says the legislature should consider expanding TANF to allow NP, nurse practitioners and physicians assistant, to provide reports. I guess my question is that a federal law that prohibits that, or is that a state issue?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer. I think that it's going to be a combination. I think some of that is going to possibly relate to the state Medicaid plan, but offhand, I don't know the answer to the question.
I'll ask my questions.
Chair Tomei, I'd just like to respond to Representative Kotek's comment, if I might. As you're all aware, this, in terms of the amendments, moved fairly quickly, and we received, most of these late Friday afternoon, and so we felt that we needed to give this committee a look at what the potential fiscal was as you're talking through what policy shifts you want to make. And so we're more than willing to work through these proposals in terms of is there another way to approach them and so forth. So it's more just to be sure you have the information in terms of what it looks like at this point to us.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm assuming, and maybe incorrectly, that the bill that the department brought to us had been included in the governor's budget, whatever the fiscal was. Is that correct?
The chair told me that is correct. That was the basis.
Okay. So can you, with the change in the bill to work on Representative Kotek's bill, so what is the increased fiscal over the governor's budget? You gave us a lot of figures. What was the total?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, what I've given you really highlights the large impacts to that. We have not taken everything and gone back and tried to compare to the governor's budget to say what's the net impact. That's something we'll be doing this week to try to bring that in terms of that net cost.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me what the fiscal for the departmental bill that was included in the governor's budget, do you know what that totaled? What amount was included in the budget?
It was like 20 million. The Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, the amount that was associated with the TANF program taking it forward was $20 million general fund.
$20 million. Follow up. Thank you. My math could be off, but I did a rough calculation of the additional numbers that I think I got them all, which added up to about $83 million. So if I subtracted the 20 that was anticipated, it seems like we're roughly $60 million over what was anticipated at this point. And my follow-up question may be more for Representative Kotek than the department at this point. I just need to clarify process, and I think my understanding, I've reached an understanding that if we send forward a bill with these various proposed increases in it, that discussion that we're looking forward to in the Ways and Means process could make adjustments, take pieces out, and move other pieces forward, or does it have to go as a package and then either come out as a package or not? Am I making sense with my question?
Yes.
And I believe it's probably more to Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Cowan. I have checked with Legislative Fiscal. It is, we will spend some money on TANF. And the $20 million earmarked in the governor's budget is an additional investment on top of what we're already spending. So it's the $20 million to implement the changes. When I talk to Legislative Fiscal, it is certainly within their purview to either find more money, which we can all debate whether that could happen and at what level, but it's also within their purview to take things out and adjust it to meet the budget that they will be trying to make. The two things that I think stick out, there are three things in the omnibus amended 2469. There's the deprivation issue, which has a larger fiscal, and I would say we need to debate some assumptions there. There's about $1 million for the child support pass-through, again, which we agree is good policy, and then there is the amendment regarding transitional medical, the $5 million. Those are the things that would stand above currently the governor's budget. And then you have the dash twos and the dash 11s as well. But that was my reading of how we were going through this. So it might not be as high as the penciling out there. But, again, I do think that's a budgetary issue. And Ways and Means can see fit to take things out if they think. And I think the way the bill has been written, we can remove things and adjust the fiscal, I think, somewhat easily because of how we've drafted it.
We are going to move along quickly. So quick question, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you went through your letter and attached the fiscal to each of these different sections, would any of them be duplicated? So when there are the additional caseload for medical coverage, are some of those counted in the fiscal for this piece of the amendment and the fiscal for this piece of the amendment?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, Yes, there would be interactions between the different pieces, and so that's why it's kind of hard to say, you know, here's the total package, because there would be pieces that would have some overlap.
Colleagues, we've got lots more questions on this. Are we going to be able to pass this on Friday, Representative? Are you going to meet with them again?
Yes, we will look at specifically, I think our goal at this point is to make sure that the technical adjustments to the Dash 12s that seem to make some sense, we get those happened, and those will be added to the next set, and we'll try to make some hand notes so we know, so you can tell that those have been included in the next grand version. And then I think it's really up to the committee's discussion through the week, and I'm happy to talk with people around the Dash 11s or in the Dash 2s. But I think we're actually close in terms of the technical issues on the omnibus amendments.
I just have to say I'm uncomfortable sending this bill with a huge fiscal that the Ways and Means is going to have to adjust a great deal. I would prefer having this committee adjust down to a reasonable point. And I'm not sure if that's feasible, and maybe that's a discussion we need to have offline. Okay. All right. Any quick questions? All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We'll be hearing from you again. We will be having another work session on Friday. And Michael Leachman, who's here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And colleagues, we're not going to get to 3113. It's obvious we're supposed to be on the floor in 5 minutes. Michael, we're going to ask you to make it quick.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, thank you. I will make this quick. For the record, my name is Mike Leachman. I'm with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I'm here to speak with you just briefly about the income limit changes that are proposed in the Dash 2 amendment. TANF is unique in terms of its income eligibility among our major public assistance programs. The food stamp program, the Oregon Health Plan, Head Start, free and reduced price school lunches, all of our major, the employment-related daycare program, all of our major public assistance programs except for TANF are based on income eligibility is based on a level of poverty. So we set a standard. We say, if you're at this level of poverty, then we want you to get this help. But with the TANF program, uniquely, we don't do that. We have a set dollar amount, and as a result, it means that each year you have to be poorer to access to be eligible for the program. The income limit for TANF has been frozen since July 1991. For a family of three, it's $616. And in 1991, that was 66% of the poverty level. Today, it's 43% of the poverty level. And each year in the future, if we don't change this, it's going to keep going down. So you have to be poorer and poorer and poorer to access these services. The Dash 2 amendment would change this. It sets the grant amount at least 33% of the poverty line, which for a family of three is where it's at now. And for other family sizes, it's a little bit above 33% of the poverty line. So immediately it would require no increase in the grant amount, which also has not increased since July 1991. But it would increase the income limit because the amendment sets the income limit at twice the grant amount. So if the grant amount is 33% of the poverty line, as the Dash 2 amendment requires, then it sets the income limit at twice that. So it would be 66% of the poverty level. Now, we should be clear that most people who this would open up access to are going to be getting a reduced grant amount because if you have zero income, you're eligible for the maximum grant amount. For a family of three, it's $471. Once you're at these higher income levels, higher income levels, your grant amount reduces as your income increases. So for the group that's in this this group that would get the benefit if we did this, the maximum amount of grant for a family of three that they would get is $162, and most would be getting less than $100 from the grant because their income is counting against the grant level. Their grant level declines as their income increases. So that's going to have an impact on the cost and something to be keep in mind. I provided you with some charts. Because of the time, I won't go all the way through them. But just to point out, just to remind you of the last one on the issue of cost, to return you to a point that I made in an earlier testimony, that spending for self-sufficiency programs in Oregon adjusted for inflation is less than half than it was in the 1993-95 biennium. And also, lastly, if this program works, and we're helping more people achieve self-sufficiency, then we should expect the cost to go down over time, that this is an investment, and to keep in mind that it is an investment that we expect to pay off in the future. Thank you very much. I'm happy to entertain quick questions.
One quick question. I see none. Thank you so much, and thank you for making it brief. All right, colleagues. We have to be on the floor. I think we're going to need to meet at 8 o'clock on Wednesday and Friday, since we're going to be on the floor at 10 in order to allow enough time to do for this. Just a minute. Do what? Oh, we can't meet at 8. Oh, darn. On Wednesday, because we haven't noticed it. We will meet at 8 on Friday, and probably as long as the floor sessions will be at 10, we'll be meeting at 8, but not on Wednesday.
Sure. Are we able to carry HB 3113 on Wednesday?
Yes. Can't we? Yes. We will carry House Bill 3113 to Wednesday.
Could we meet at 8 to do 3113 since it's already noticed for today?
We'll try. We'll let you know.
Okay. Oh.
That'd be great. Okay. All right. Any further questions? All right. I close the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness. Thank you very much.
Evaporated.
Hi.
How are you?
No, it just happened. I just heard this morning. Just right now.
What?
Sorry. So we'll wait till next month.
Well,
why would you want us to wait and then plug in?
That's okay. Go ahead. Okay. Did you need to talk with me?
Oh, I need them.
In South Carolina?
No, this is for mental health. It's using abuse and
screening your employees.
Yeah. Oh, right. Okay.
I spoke to Representative Johnson.